You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Hey, listeners, and welcome back to National Security Law Today. This week, we're re-airing one of our most compelling recent episodes, a conversation with best-selling author and award-winning AI reporter, Karen Howe. Karen is the author of Empire of AI, a book that reveals how ambition, secrecy, and competition transformed OpenAI from a small nonprofit into one of the most powerful and controversial tech companies in the world. We're bringing this episode back for two important reasons. First, it sets the stage for our upcoming episode series, The Risks of Unchecked AI Development. And second, it ties directly to the 35th Annual Review of the Field of National Security Law, CLE Conference, happening next week, November 13th and 14th, at the Omni Shoreham Hotel in Washington, D.C. This year's conference theme is Technology, National Security, and the Law, Keeping Pace with Innovation. It's two full days packed with keynotes and panels exploring how emerging technologies like AI are reshaping the national security landscape. If this topic piques your interest, don't miss Professor Margaret Hughes' panel, The AI Arms Race and National Security Law, taking place on Friday, November 14th at 10:30 a.m. Her panel will explore how artificial intelligence is reshaping national security, from military strategy and cyber defense to the ethical and legal questions surrounding autonomous technology. Whether you're a lawyer, a student, or simply curious about how tech and law intersect, this is the conference to be at. You'll find registration details and a full agenda linked in today's episode description. And now, here's Elisa's conversation with Karen Howe.
Now, if you read one book this year, it has to be Empire of AI by Karen Howe. Now, it reads like an intrigue novel instead of a chronicle of 6 years in the life of the once nonprofit known as OpenAI. I think in the future, they may have to change their name to something like Closed AI or Competitive AI. This is a startup that originally said that it existed to help all of mankind. By some indices, Karen has been assessed as one of the five most influential women in the world right now. But she's actually sitting in New Jersey, which is great. Karen, thank you so much for coming in. First of all, I see you're everywhere all the time. I know you were in the Netherlands, I think, last week. We're glad you made time for us.
Thank you so much for having me, Elisa.
You spent years watching OpenAI and collecting information. My question is, how did you pull that off? And did you ever worry that if you're going to shoot the king, don't miss?
Well, I kind of stumbled into covering OpenAI, honestly, not because of any foresight, but largely by coincidence. I was covering AI for MIT Technology Review, which is a publication that really focuses on the emerging cutting edge research in across different technology disciplines. And there used to be this saying at Tech Review that if there was any kind of commercial intent around a technology, that was already too late for us. And so OpenAI came on my radar because it was conceived of as a fundamental AI research lab at the time. And there were only so many top leading fundamental AI research labs in the world. So I was sort of looking at all of them as part of my remit. And in 2019, I became particularly fascinated because OpenAI started making this transition to Nest, a for-profit within the nonprofit. And I thought, because they were messaging at the time, this transition was something that would allow them to create a self-governance structure that would kind of resolve the tension between needing to raise capital and also retaining conviction in its original mission. I thought that this was a fascinating case study to explore in how to actually realign the incentives around innovation in the public interest, and that if they had successfully in fact pulled this off, that everyone in the world should know about this and should be replicating it. That was then. And then I ended up writing a profile critical of OpenAI because as I discovered through my profile, where I interviewed around 4 dozen, I think, people at the time, I realized that there was this fundamental disconnect between how OpenAI was actually messaging itself publicly versus how it operated behind closed doors. It very much conceived of itself as antithetical to Silicon Valley's values. I found that it was just part and parcel of the reckless, kind of competitive, secretive culture ethos of Silicon Valley innovation. And fast forward to when ChatGPT came out, I realized that there was kind of a lack of context around the global conversation that had been sparked around AI when everyone suddenly started grappling with how advanced the technology had become and who had actually built this technology and what values and worldview did they have and how did that then inform the decisions around what the shape of the technology ultimately became. This technology is not inevitable. We ended up with something like ChatGPT. It is really much based on a kind of profit motive and an ideological motive that stewed within OpenAI. And when I started reaching out to people to interview, I was surprised to find that many current and former employees were quite intent or keen on speaking with me, in part because I had been following the company for such a long time. And some people had really loved the profile that I had written at the time, thinking that it was highly accurate. And so it ended up being a lot less of a challenge reporting and getting people to talk than I initially thought. And that is what ultimately helped me interview over 90 current and former OpenAI employees and executives and over 250 people for the book at large to put together the story.
You're very good at sorting data than yourself, because that's a lot of interviews. You mentioned in the book something that I think is little understood outside of the tech industry right now, which is this non-disparagement clause. I think they all do that, right? I mean, I think other authors, other sort of whistleblowers have faced that. Did you detect at the time that it was something that simple, or were you afraid that they thought they would be shunned? I'm just curious, because you're really serving as the fourth estate. If you think of us living right now in a techno-autocracy, I think one of the questions that people have is, you are an unusual journalist. You have an engineering degree from MIT, but I think a lot of people who approach this stuff, they're challenged by things like these non-disparagement clauses, their own lack of technological wherewithal, and then in walks Karen Howe. And I feel, and I felt when I read this, this is a model for the new fourth estate. You know, I don't know if, do you see that? I mean, do you recognize, I don't know if you feel the same way that I do, that this is a major watershed event?
So the first thing I would say is it is common for companies, tech companies in particular, to have non-disclosure agreements, but it is quite rare for what OpenAI did to have a non-disparagement agreement that also has a clause saying that if you reveal the agreement or break the agreement, that they can claw back equity. Like that was a really dramatic, aggressive tactic that OpenAI specifically used, which was part of the reason why there was a huge PR crisis about it. I've been doing investigations and reporting on the tech industry for a while, so I'm quite familiar with navigating NDAs and getting people to feel comfortable enough to talk in spite of an NDA. And really, it comes down to, I walk them through my full process of how I make sure that all of my sources who speak to me anonymously and break NDA maintain anonymity. How do I make sure that I don't accidentally, unintentionally reveal who is talking to me just simply based on the triangulation of facts that they give me? So I'm extremely careful. I walk them through the process. I allow them to ask me any questions, and I give them full control of the information they give me, in the sense that I tell them at any point, if they change their mind, they can decide before I hit publish to take that information back. I'm not trying in any way to corner them into a situation where they give me information that jeopardizes their own safety and security. And so that's always a baseline for me. And that is what gets people comfortable speaking. And as I develop relationships with them, we have many conversations over time. They gain trust because they will tell me some information. They realize that, you know, 6 months later, they still have not been caught. And then they'll give me more information and they still haven't been caught. And so there's sort of a track record that we build over time where I demonstrate to them that I am able to keep everything secure. In terms of like this being a new model of investigation, I don't know that I necessarily see that it that way. Like one of the things that I do part of my time now is training journalists around the world on how to cover AI through accountability lens. And like I work with the Pulitzer Center on this program called the AI Spotlight Series, where we've trained at this point over 2,000 journalists around the world covering AI in this way. And I feel very strongly, and I say to all of the journalists who go through our training program, that anyone can do this reporting. There's nothing unique about the fact that I have an engineering degree. Like, I really do not think that that gives me some kind of magical leg up in scrutinizing these companies. I do think the one leg up it does give me is Silicon Valley is a very elitist space. So I might be able to more quickly gain people's trust or access because of these superficial signals that they might value. But in terms of like actually getting into the meat and the heart of what these companies are doing at a global scale and recognizing the sheer amount of power that they've consolidated and recognizing that journalists have long played the role of holding power to account. Any journalist from anywhere can do that work as long as they have the vocabulary, the framework, and that's what we teach them. We teach them the vocabulary. We teach them the technical guts of how an AI system works. We teach them all of the different environmental, social, labor facets that they should be tracking and give that framework for developing their stories.
Part of the thing that left me a little cold in the book was the portrait of Sam Altman. And, you know, he's a very flawed figure at best. Has your opinion of him changed over time? And do you see him as different from any other of these tech CEOs? Because you paint a picture of somebody that I suspect is a little different.
Yeah, I would say that he is, there are similarities and there are differences. The things that makes him distinct is that he's really charismatic, which you can't really say of some of the tech CEOs. You know, when people describe meeting with Altman face to face, they always describe how disarmed they are by how humble he appears to be, how soft-spoken he appears to be, and how attentive he is. Like he, you know, he's described by some people as the Michael Jordan of listening, where you really feel like he's giving you his undivided attention. He is empathizing with everything that you're saying, understanding it, adapting to it. But the thing that then makes him controversial, and I think is maybe not entirely unique to him as a tech CEO, is that he then turns around and will do what he wants anyway. And there seems to be like not necessarily a relationship between the things that he does and what he says that he will do to different people. And I think the other thing that makes him unique is that people generally feel that they can't quite articulate, even after working with him very closely, working with him for a long time, they can't quite articulate what he truly believes as a person, what he truly values. And that is quite distinctive from other tech CEOs that I've covered and how people describe them. And that is what makes, I think, Altman very enigmatic, and it gives him a lot of power in that people, when they have these meetings with him, they're not quite sure what to expect. And then they come away kind of feeling quite persuaded by whatever case he lays out for why they should give him money or why they should work for his venture or whatever it is. But over time, some people end up feeling quite intensely that he somehow successfully manipulated them into contributing to something that they didn't actually believe in. I think for my opinion, I just didn't really know what to think when I first started the book, because there were a lot of different things floating around about who Sam Altman was and his character. You know, there were people who were talking about how he was one of the greatest tech leaders of our generation. And as someone who went to MIT and worked in Silicon Valley, and I have many, many friends who've worked in Silicon Valley, Altman was a towering figure. I mean, he was the president of Y Combinator long before he was the CEO of OpenAI. And people spoke very highly of him in certain circles that I traversed. But then at the same time, there were all of these allegations about him being a compulsive liar, being a manipulator, being abusive, and these things. And I just had absolutely no idea what was the story. And it is really hard to also get to the bottom of that, because you will ask different people and they will say one or the other thing. And it's like, okay, well, this is just a matter of opinion. But what I started doing as I was reporting the book was I started asking people What did Altman tell you in this specific meeting at this specific time in the company about what you were doing and why? And because I interviewed so many people through the history of the company, there were enough moments in time where I could ask a collection of people that question. And I started realizing that they had been told different things at different times. And that's when I think a more grounded picture emerged of the kind of tactics that he engages in to be really persuasive and kind of push people in a particular direction that he wants them to go, but leaves this kind of lack of trust in his wake.
Yeah, he's also sort of self-identified as an individual who suffers from acute, I think, anxiety. And in reading it, I had to wonder how much that factored into his behavior. If he's constantly trying to please everybody who's in front of him and give them the answer they want, while at the same time having a vision for what he is that he wants to do. And I think you also describe him as somebody who came under the influence of the drug ketamine for a period of time, and his behavior seemed to change. I don't know if that's still an issue for him. If you look at some of the symptomology that's described, it sounds like some of the behaviors that we've seen in both he and Elon Musk, if you believe that they're not personality attributed, could be enhanced by Silicon Valley's sudden love affair with this, I guess, what's an anti-anxiety drug. But I found that part especially interesting in a country that is, you know, taking the position that drugs are bad. And now these people are sort of morphing into world leaders. But let's talk a little bit about, you briefly mentioned this sort of nonprofit model, and then it shifted. And I wish I'd had a money wager on this and sort of selected a point spread, because I feel like we all knew that was going to happen. It was just a question of when. Talk a little bit about just that transition and, you know, what occasioned it, because it was a very weird thing to hear this. Oh, we're doing this all for the betterment of humanity. And see, you know, all these great tech minds like Susskind, I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, and I guess Mira as well, coming into this company under one paradigm, and then it just shifts. And, you know, it looks like they tried to hold on for that rocket ride, but, you know, eventually they left.
Yeah, when I first started covering OpenAI, I think I had a different perception than I do now, in that I, at the time, I thought there was an idealistic origin that was sort of corrupted along the way. And now that I've finished reporting the book, I feel like actually there was a seed of corruption in the original conception of OpenAI, because Elon Musk and Sam Altman came together specifically to create the nonprofit as a counter to Google. They did not like, and Musk did not like in particular, that Google was dominating AI development and had developed a monopoly on top AI research talent. And so really, it was an egotistical project from the very beginning of, we don't like what Google's doing. We want to be the ones that develop AI. We want AI to be in our image. And so you could say that the transition to then having a for-profit within the nonprofit was a logical consequence of that egotistical drive of wanting to be first, of wanting to outcompete Google. And that was exactly the motivation of creating a vehicle for raising an abundance of capital, was in order to be the leading AI organization, in order to cross over to that finish line first, we just need to outpace every other player. And the best way to do that is to take existing techniques rather than engage in fundamental AI research, because fundamental AI research is on a timeline that is unpredictable. Just take the existing research and just pour a whole bunch of data and into these models and put them on larger and larger supercomputers over time. And that ended up being a very cash-intensive endeavor, cash-intensive path for AI development. And so then they needed to resolve this bottleneck of, how do we get a huge amount of capital for doing this? And so this for-profit is born, and that becomes the solve for how they get all of this capital. But for the longest time, I think Altman was quite successful in framing to the organization and to the public that there was still a genuine desire to maintain the mission. I'm not so convinced in hindsight that, you know, there was ever really a genuine conviction in the mission, even in the beginning, but he did ride the reputational wave that OpenAI had built on the back of being a nonprofit and having this mission. But one of the challenges of being this weird Frankenstein organization, because, like, depending on what era an employee joined the company, they had a fundamentally different conception of what OpenAI even was. So early employees, they still really felt like OpenAI was different from other Silicon Valley companies because it was ultimately on paper a nonprofit, and it was ultimately conceived of as this mission-driven organization. And they still really held on to that belief that there was this, at the very least, still a vestige left of that original mission and that nonprofit ethos. But then people who joined the organization after the for-profit was created, and especially several years after the for-profit was created, they just thought OpenAI was a company like any other company, and that there was really no difference between OpenAI and Facebook and Google. And that was just, it was really fascinating because it's sort of like OpenAI is a prism for any employee to project their own ideas and values of what the organization actually is. And I've never encountered that before at any other organization.
I like the idea of it initially because I feel that we're constrained in doing good because we're a capitalist society and corporations have to achieve ROI. You know, if there were a way to do a hybrid model, say to the benefit of all humanity or even just the American people, I mean, that sounds great, but this is my personal opinion. If you look at this and how it unfolded, it looks almost like it was sort of a ruse to get a kumbaya reputational bump and then sort of fade to IPO, I'm the rich guy. That part made me a little sad. Only because I would like to see a model that could be successful and sort of challenging the way we normally do things to the betterment of all of us. But, you know, it's not just that it failed. It just looks like it completely flipped upside down and backwards. One of the more interesting parts of your book and also about what the conversations were there, like maybe kind of quiet conversations, was how one of the projects was like a Manhattan project. Do you want to talk about that just a little bit? Because I think everything serves as a cautionary tale. And it's interesting that you would go back to a project that, you know, spawned the nuclear weapon.
This is something that Altman started using to describe OpenAI from the very beginning. When he first approached Elon Musk about co-founding the organization together, he described it as, I think we should build an AI Manhattan project. And all the way until maybe present day, I'm not sure if this is true literally at this moment, but until very recently, at the very least, this is language that was used to describe what OpenAI was to new employees onboarding into the company. You are joining a very serious, grave endeavor that is akin to an AI Manhattan project. And part of the fascination, I guess, around this analogy is that people who were joining OpenAI really did feel like the mythology of the organization was originally, we are going to build a good so-called artificial general intelligence before the bad people build the bad one. And that felt very like we're going to build the good nuclear weapon before the Nazis build the bad one, if there is such a thing as a good nuclear weapon. But I think the other thing that makes this analogy extremely useful is that it heightens the stakes to create enormous amount of secrecy within a company that ultimately is trying to protect intellectual property that is very easy to replicate. You know, like these companies that build closed source models, their biggest threat is just open source model developers that keep replicating exactly what they're doing internally and giving it to people for free when the model developers are trying to charge like thousands of dollars a month for the same technology. And so there was this sincere cohort of people within OpenAI that genuinely felt that there was this grave responsibility that they were engaged in, where they were trying to usher in a technology that could, if it went well, bring humanity to utopia. But if it went badly, you know, kill everyone. This was a sincere belief among a certain group. So the Manhattan Project felt very relevant, but it's also one that is just politically, rhetorically useful because it becomes this mechanism by which to convince all employees and the public that this is an extremely delicate, high stakes endeavor. And it justifies why you need to have just a tiny group of people controlling this powerful technology.
One of the big issues that we've discussed over the past few years before we get on the real cataclysmic topic of energy is the data sources that are used to train the models and feed the models. And, you know, there's an old expression, and this is for our listeners that maybe lack any sort of technical know-how, but garbage in, garbage out, racism in, racism out. I mean, there's some things that were happening that I mean, I must admit, I doubt seriously anybody intended these consequences, but they occurred. I mean, I just was rattled when I got to the point in your book where they sort of accepted a lower data set. Can you talk a little bit about that? What happened and why?
Yeah, so this is one of my fundamental critiques of Silicon Valley's approach to AI development. And I guess I'll just very quickly preface this with AI refers to a collection of so many different types of technologies. And so the critique that I lay out in my book is about one particular type of AI, which is what OpenAI led the charge with, a scale at all costs approach to AI development. And what happened when OpenAI was like, okay, we want to try to get to the finish line first. We want to beat Google. So we're going to take these existing techniques and we're just going to pour ever more data into these existing models. They initially started with this idea of curating their data set, because when they were building the very first GPT models, it wasn't that large. It didn't need that much data. But as they continue to explode in orders of magnitude, the size of the data sets that they wanted to put into these models, it suddenly became kind of impossible for them to maintain a high bar of data quality. So they went from training their models on something like 8 million curated articles and web pages in the early GPT models to suddenly these like petabytes of unfiltered data scraped from all over the internet. And, you know, they were really trying to go everywhere, downloading this really common data set called Common Crawl that is regularly scraped from all corners of the web, including really dark corners of the web. They were transcribing YouTube videos just to get more, generate more text data to feed into the models. And they were pirating books and they were scanning textbooks. And they basically, like one of the sources that spoke to me described it as essentially any single web page that they could find that did not have a sign posted on it saying, do not scrape, they scraped and then poured that all in. And so you end up with the entire toxic cesspit of the internet in these models. And then you wonder why these models will end up engaging in horrific behaviors, such as the recent spate of mental health cases where teenagers are, after long extended, intense dialogue with these models, end up killing themselves. Like, these are like root issues, as you said, garbage in, garbage out, that OpenAI is trying to solve with very superficial safety mechanisms, where after pouring in all this garbage, they just try to staple on some content moderation filtering or some detection, automated detection systems to just see like how many times someone might be prompting the model for mental health issues. I mean, ultimately, users can figure out different ways of getting around those safety mechanisms. And once they do, they are wrestling with a model that is at its core trained on rotten material. One other thing that I'll add is this was true of not just the text generation models, the GPT models. It was also true of the DALL-E models, OpenAI's image generation tools, where initially when they first started training these DALL-E models, they decided kind of in passing that they would train it on pornographic material because it was representative of the human experience. And once they got from DALL-E 2 to DALL-E 3, they actually dramatically expanded the amount of pornographic material that went into DALL-E 3, in part because they realized that at the data quantity regime that they were trying to operate in, if they took out the pornographic material, they simply would not meet the data quantity requirements. And the model got worse at generating faces of women.
Lovely.
Yeah.
I can't imagine sort of what these conversations must have looked like. But, you know, when I hear these things, I have to wonder, you know, if this isn't being run by a bunch of under-socialized people who are so excited about what they're doing, they have no capacity to consider consequences, and they just see any restrictions as like a barrier to their goals. I think that's, you know, science is exciting, and this is, we've seen this before. People get going, and they're so goal-oriented that they often just can't see these potential horrible end states.
I think that's exactly right. Like, I think to really understand the psychology of people who work at these companies and made these decisions, you do have to recognize that they genuinely thought that they were making the right decisions and they were genuinely working towards a profoundly, positively transformative mission. Of course, some of them in hindsight looked back and they changed their mind. But in the moment, I think they felt like they were being very thoughtful and intentional with these decisions, you know, like with the pornographic material, like their justification. They did have, you know, this discussion and they were like, no, well, that is a part of human experience. Why should we have the right to take that out? They had these ways of weighing these things and kind of talking themselves into positions that felt internally coherent. But one of the biggest challenges and criticisms that I have of these types of organizations is these types of decisions should not just be made by a handful of people that are kind of philosophizing based on their own values and their own worldview about what is right or not right. That should have been a decision that the public should have had participation in. And experts should have been able to weigh in on, you know, like child safety experts should have been able to weigh in on, because child safety experts would have been able to immediately recognize if you put pornographic material into an image generation tool, even if you're not putting child pornography into the image generation tool, if you also then put children's images into that tool, it's going to be able to create synthetic child pornography. And that's going to become a huge problem. And that is part of the reason why democratic governance works and makes things stronger, and why in this particular instance, when there is absolutely no participation from the public, from different fields of expertise, that you end up with such profound unintended consequences on the other end.
What happened to trust and safety mechanisms at OpenAI? I mean, we've talked to them in the past, and we didn't get a lot of answers to our questions. What did you observe? Because it sounds like a sieve with liquid in it that just kept emptying in terms of this sort of trust and safety, or whatever they called themselves, group inside of OpenAI.
One of the things that's kind of strange about OpenAI's history is that there were a lot of different safety teams within the history, but they had different conceptions of what safety actually means. So before there was a trust and safety team, which usually refers to the discipline of like figuring out how to make sure people don't do bad things on the internet, there was this AI safety team that was much more about how do we make sure that our AI doesn't go rogue. And this is based on this kind of philosophical thought experiment or this belief system that AI might one day truly replicate human intelligence and therefore might become conscious, have sentience, or have agency, and then end up deciding that humans are worthless and will do something bad to humans and potentially kill everyone. And I cannot stress enough that this is a theoretical philosophical thought construct that has turned into a belief system. There are people who now genuinely believe that this could come to pass, but there is actually no scientific evidence that it ever would. And so when in the early days, there was this AI safety team, they didn't even touch trust and safety issues because they were not operating in the realm of like how the real world works and how people end up abusing these technologies and how to prevent them from abusing these technologies. They were really thinking more about these kind of existential or catastrophic, theoretical, long-term risks that could one day arise. And that's part of the problem, is that OpenAI was developing this really increasingly sophisticated technology that would wreak havoc in a real world context, but they were not spending much time thinking about those real world consequences. They were thinking about the theoretical consequences. Then OpenAI, they scaled faster than any other company in history, right? Like when they released ChatGPT, they suddenly had an enormous, enormous number of users sign on, and they were just simply trying to get their servers to stop crashing. Like they were trying to hire like 100 people a week. Like it was insanity to try and scale and support this suddenly viral product that they had accidentally put into the world. At that point, they did have a small trust and safety team, but my God, it was completely insufficient for the sheer amount of users that were suddenly engaging in this technology and doing, you know, some delightful things and some like bad, awful things. The issue is that when they actually started engaging in these more real-world consequence type issues, there was not a lot of runway between like the creation of that team and suddenly that team needing to be like 100 times larger than it was. And so there were just a lot of things that fell through the cracks. And because that team didn't exist during like the fundamental creation of the technology in the first place, these models were not designed from the ground up in thinking about these issues. And so it is a team that has been just trying to retroactively plug gaps and trying to figure out how to slap on safety mechanisms post hoc that are ultimately insufficient because of this, you know, the fundamental problem that we already talked about, which is like the technology at its core is trained on some rotten material.
I have to say that one of the things that comes to mind when I think about what you're talking about, which is sort of the after the fact surface effort to try to fix some of these problems because they were so excited, they raced ahead. It reminds me a lot of the subprime crisis where the subprime loans metastasized into the entire global economic system. And fixing it was nearly cataclysmic to our economy in the time. And it was pulled off barely. But I think that it changed how Americans viewed their own power structure. It had a long-term souring effect. But I've spent a lot of time on this podcast talking about energy. And I think when I started, a lot of people shrugged, like, why is this the biggest national security issue that we face? I'm not suggesting that we're about to have an energy Armageddon, but if they can't compute more efficiently, I mean, the globe would be literally covered with data centers and the planet would be 200 degrees all the time. What are your thoughts on this? And what are their thoughts on this? Is there any effort, or are they just in a race with each other and they're sort of forgetting this massive potential environmental and human consequence?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right that this is the most urgent and colossal issue potentially globally, because yeah, the climate crisis is being accelerated to the tipping point, and that is literally going to affect every single person in this world in devastating ways if we don't actually right the ship. To just try and describe, I guess, the sheer scale of the AI industry and the energy issue. So these companies, like, as they pour more and more data into their models, they're also building larger and larger supercomputers, like the largest supercomputers we've ever seen in history. Meta and OpenAI at this point have both developed plans to build single supercomputers that are the size of Manhattan that would use the power draw of Manhattan. Like, this is insanity. We have literally never seen this kind of infrastructure be built. And it's not just one of these supercomputers. They're trying to blanket, as you said, the Earth with supercomputers of this size and this energy intensity. So McKinsey came out with a report earlier this year that projected that if we were to actually look at in the next 5 years, all of the different plans that they have in a conservative scenario, these data centers just for the AI industry would consume as much energy as two states of California. And in an accelerated scenario, it would consume as much energy as six states of California. That is like adding six states of California to the global grid, the fifth largest economy in the world to the global grid. Most of that is coming from fossil fuels, which is why natural gas and coal executives are celebrating, because AI has single-handedly revitalized their business. And like, some people, you know, will sometimes say to me, well, you know, the internet has always run on data centers. Social media has always run on data centers. This is of a completely different scale. Like, before, data centers were being built at a speed that was roughly equal to the pace of innovation for reducing the energy consumption of data centers or increasing the energy efficiency. So in the US, we've had flatlined energy demand for the last decade. And in the EU, there's been declining energy demand, even as there has been more data center expansion. We are now laying down data centers at a rate that is leading to a historic rise in energy consumption around the world. And it is just these data centers that is leading to that historic rise. So it is extremely alarming. And the way that people within these companies think about it, I mean, some of them think that ultimately, you know, they genuinely believe they are recreating human intelligence in computers. And they genuinely believe that when that happens, that'll just completely solve the climate crisis, you know, with a snap of someone's fingers, because more infinite intelligence in the world, digital intelligence in the world, will suddenly be able to do what we humans have not been able to do, which is overcome this emergency. And so they feel like the ends justify the means. It's okay to dial up the pressure on the climate emergency if it means that we might ultimately get to a light at the end of the tunnel and totally resolve the issue with the wave of their magic AI wand. Other people, they just simply haven't thought about it. Sometimes I mention this to people within the AI industry and they're like, oh, that never occurred to me.
I mean, is there any work being done that did you suss out any place that would admit that they're doing any work to try to compute more efficiently? It certainly doesn't appear to be happening in OpenAI, but have you seen anybody that's working on this? Is there any place we can put our hope, or is this something that we need to see immediately?
There have been efforts within OpenAI, but they're not nearly that urgent. They are always compute constrained and they're always trying to get more out of their compute, but it's not driven by environmental concerns. It's sort of driven by like, how do we just increase our runway in developing more AI systems and serving more products? But there are already existing techniques for dramatically increasing the compute efficiency of these models. And DeepSeek, which was the Chinese model that came out of Highflyer earlier this year, they just took a bunch of those existing computationally efficient techniques, combined them together in really clever ways. And that was the reason why they were able to create a model that was extraordinarily less computationally intensive, but was able to achieve similar capabilities to OpenAI's models at the time. So they exist, they should be applied urgently, but you're right that there also needs to be more fundamental research to continue innovating even further, because DeepSeek ultimately, we shouldn't just stop there. We should be actually pushing and developing new techniques that actually get us these types of capabilities or different capabilities with even a smaller footprint. And the unfortunate reality is there is not a ton of research being done in this regard, in part because the amount of funding within AI research and development is almost solely being poured into just scaling the models rather than finding fundamentally new paradigms to build these models with.
Yeah, I think a lot of people see this as a sort of a wealth building industry, period. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a tendency to place a lot of hope in what AI can deliver. But I have a theory, and you can shoot me down, but when I saw all the tech leaders coming to court the president, as they have other presidents, it was my thought that they wanted two things. They wanted access to energy rightfully needed by Americans that they pay for without restrictions, because they know that they're in this competition. But the second thing was that they wanted there to be zero regulations. They wanted another Communications Decency Act, Section 230, that would, you know, sort of give them the unfettered ability to develop, and then we'll deal with the problems later, never mind if it sort of breaks society or forces us into some situation that we can't anticipate right now. But I wonder what you thought when you saw the inauguration ongoing. Did you think this is about energy? Did that cross your mind at the time?
Yeah. Well, when Trump, I think, said drill, baby, drill, like, I thought it was no coincidence that he was saying that and then immediately announcing the Stargate Initiative, which is the $500 billion project that OpenAI, Oracle, and SoftBank partnered on to try and dramatically expand computational infrastructure in the US. Like, I thought that that was, you know, there was a strategic compatibility in those two messages of, we're going to supercharge all this infrastructure build out in the US, and we're going to open up all of the oil fields in the US to support it.
Yeah. And I mean, I heard remarkably few journalists tap into that possibility. I heard a lot of sort of moral judgments, bad, you know, this is bad, you know, they're hypocritical. I heard that kind of thing. I never heard it analyzed in terms of their corporate goals. Neither did I hear a conversation about the fact that we have a really ballooning national debt. And there might be a desire to use some mechanism like this for a period of time to pay it down. By that, I mean, you know, a sudden uptick of energy. Anyway, I had a reaction to it. And I wondered a couple other things, you know, on the second part of that, which was sort of the don't regulate us. You heard that too from inside, right? They don't want restrictions.
there are a lot of different opinions within OpenAI, but yes, the dominant one is that they absolutely cannot have anything in their way because they are now in an all-out race against competitors to make sure they maintain their dominance in this AI race. And some of them still believe they are ultimately on this quest to build this profound artificial general intelligence that is going to bring utopia. And so to them, it's a moral wrong to have things, obstacles in the way of getting to that utopia. It is the most prevalent opinion internally.
Let's pivot for just a second. We're living in a time where there is increased corporate consolidation, and no less so, I don't think, in the tech space. But I wondered how you felt when you saw some of the chip deals that were being hashed out for OpenAI. I wondered to get your reaction to that.
I guess my overwhelming feeling was just like deep frustration. These deals are ridiculous. Like, $100 billion. Like, is this real money? Like, I just don't understand how anyone can still kind of buy into the line that companies like OpenAI are delivering, saying, yeah, we're going to reach an extraordinary utopia by just spending trillions of dollars and laying all these data centers to cover the earth. These deals are structured so weirdly too. Like with the NVIDIA one, it was just like a letter of intent, and it's not really clear yet whether the money is actually going to transfer. And then with the AMD deal, like OpenAI, I was seeing all these memes on the internet about how OpenAI is saying, like, give us these chips, but we're not going to pay for these chips. We're just going to somehow, we're just going to like trade money back and forth by you giving us a share of your stocks.
Yeah, it was like a barter, a suggestion for some sort of weird power barter.
Yeah, and there have been some really amazing stories. Like Bloomberg had a visualization showing the money laundering, basically, that is happening in this ecosystem right now, where every single company is sort of trading with every other company the exact same money. But it's creating all of this economic activity that appears to be positive. And I saw this amazing economics analysis saying that right now, the entire U.S. market is AI. Like, if you look at any of the stocks that are unrelated to AI, the market's declining, and it's only the stocks related to AI that are floating and making an appearance that the market is strong. And this analysis was saying that the Trump administration has extreme incentives to perpetuate this mirage because it is one of the things, maybe the only things, that's now providing it political cover to continue doing all the other things that it's doing.
Yeah, and it's loading the stock market and making the numbers look good. But I think it's going to take one fracture for that to be the other way. The other thing is, I don't know what the metrics are. Like, I don't know what their dates for delivery on any of the promised claims of AI are. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of sort of nebulous talk about what it can deliver. I don't really hear a lot of concrete metrics. And I'm just waiting for the day, you know, when people start to say, well, wait a minute, you know, the emperor's really not dressed. What have we gotten for this? We've gotten a large language model that's, you know, I can generate a shopping list and that's great, or come up with some vacation ideas. But how is this really doing anything? And I don't know. It's going to be interesting to see. I would like to watch it closely. But your time watching Sam Altman, I know he refused to talk to you. Or I don't know if you refused or you just never had the chance. But, you know, this has not been a good week for the tech bros. You know, there have been leaked statements by Peter Thiel talking about, you know, it's hard to hide money. And those follow on his statement that he'd like to control the public with the use of technology. You know, I feel like Sam Altman, you know, has enough sense not to say these things aloud. Do you see like an end of these titans at any point, and what might trigger that? And do you think that they perceive their own sort of mortality?
I'm really optimistic that we will get to a point where we contain the power of these titans, contain the power of the empires of AI, as I call them in my book. And I think there's kind of two different prongs of the strategy for getting there. One is that we need a broad coalition of many different types of collective action movements that are applying pressure points to all of the different pillars that prop up the empires and their power. In order to build these technologies, they have to have access to an extraordinary amount of resources that ultimately are actually collectively owned by the public. Like, they need all of that data and all of that intellectual property. And we're seeing artists and writers starting to sue them in droves. And this is a huge pressure point to chip away at, like, one of the things that props up the AI industry. We're seeing communities around the world that are pushing against data center development and actually being successful in suspending projects. That's yet another pillar that they're chipping away at. We're seeing students and teachers and employees across various industries starting to protest the use of AI in their different institutions. That's yet, like, adoption is yet another pillar that needs to be chipped away at. And so we are seeing, like, all of these different voices coming out in the public, starting to demand a different relationship that the tech industry should be having with people. And then the second thing that really needs to happen is there just needs to be a reallocation of capital towards more true innovation, both in AI, like different types of AI systems, and also a distribution of capital towards other types of innovation. Like, we just need more money funneled into all of those other types of technologies as well, and to create just a more robust innovation ecosystem again, that's not just completely collapsed on a single set of ideas and a single set of individuals. I do feel very strongly that we are going to get there, because people are fed up. And when you have a global population being fed up, there will be change.
I just want to thank you for writing the book and for coming to talk to us. We will hyperlink to vendors where you can purchase this book. I do recommend it.
Thank you so much.
All right. And thank you for listening to NSLT. Please remember to subscribe to our cast on your listening app of choice. Share this episode with a friend. And remember, again, one of our philosophies here at the Standing Committee is have civil conversations with people you disagree with. In this podcast, we recognize that we still live in a culture with greater diversity of thought than really any other. You can follow us on LinkedIn, Facebook, Substack. We're kind of out there everywhere. Our writer, producer, and host is me, Elisa Poteet. I'm always here in my individual capacity. Our editor and my co-producer is Francis Burkham. And Tasia Hawkins-Blakely is our program manager. And my co-producer is Holly McMahon. She's a woman who can do anything, anytime, any place. It's freakish. Social media and research support comes from Alana Coopersmith. And of course, we have the backing of probably the smartest people in Washington, D.C., who comprise the Standing Committee on Law and National Security. Shout out to my committee members who are helping me on this, Margaret Hugh of William & Mary Law. You will soon know her in fame regarding AI. Sunita Patel and Lala Kadir, who are going to help me as I develop the next series on scaling. And we hope and beg that Karen will come back to us and maybe hit us with another good book. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.